So I would like to welcome everybody once again to the Sunday Feast program. So tonight I'm going to read a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. I'll chant the Sanskrit and read the English translation and our spiritual master Srila Prabhupada's purport. And sort of, you know, speak about that a little bit. How many people are here for the first time? Quite a few. Wow, really? Raise your hand again. One, two, three. Wow. Like about 12 people. Okay, wonderful. Thank you for coming. So I'll try to make this so that you all can understand what's going on. Okay, so this is a verse. This is Bhagavad Gita is our scripture. Bhagavad Gita, in Sanskrit, it means the song of God. And the idea was it was spoken by God himself 5,000 years ago when he was present here on earth. So for us, it's perfect knowledge. You know, obviously, if you're going to get knowledge from God himself, you're going to have perfect knowledge. So that's the Bhagavad Gita. So I'm going to be chanting. The Bhagavad Gita was actually spoken originally in the Sanskrit language, which is one of the, like a mother tongue, a very seminal language. And I'll just be reading like one statement that Lord Sri Krishna, that's who spoke Bhagavad Gita 5,000 years ago, made at that time. So it goes, Avyakta Shara Iti Yoktas Tamahu Paramam Gatim Yamprapyana Navartante Tadama Paramam Mama. And the translation for that is, that which the Vedantists, which means studiers, people who are studying the scriptures, okay, describe as unmanifest and infallible, that which is known as the supreme destination, that place from which, having attained, one never returns, that is my supreme abode. Now this is the commentary. That was Krishna's statement, Lord Sri Krishna, the speaker of Bhagavad Gita. And now I'm going to read the commentary on that statement by our founder, spiritual master, founder Acharya for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which is the name of this organization, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. So he says, the supreme abode of the personality of Godhead Krishna is described in the Brahma Samhita as Chintamani Dham, a place where all desires are fulfilled. And the supreme abode of Lord Krishna, known as Goloka Vrindavan, is full of palaces made of touchstone. There are also trees called desire trees that supply any type of edible upon demand. And there are cows known as Sarabi cows, which supply a limitless supply of milk. In this abode, the Lord is served by hundreds of thousands of goddesses of fortune, Lakshmis, and he is called Govinda, the primal Lord and the cause of all causes. The Lord is accustomed to blow his flute, Venam Kvanantam. His transcendental form is the most attractive in all the worlds. His eyes are like lotus petals, and the color of his body is like the color of clouds. He is so attractive that his beauty excels that of thousands of cupids. He wears saffron cloth, a garland around his neck, and a peacock feather in his hair. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna only gives a small hint of his personal abode, Goloka Vrindavan, which is the supermost planet in the spiritual kingdom. A vivid description is given in the Brahma Samhita. Vedic literature state that there is nothing superior to the abode of the Supreme Godhead, and that abode is the ultimate destination, Purushan Param Kinshit Sakashta Paramam Gati. When one attains to it, he never returns to this material world. Krishna's supreme abode and Krishna himself are non-different, being of the same quality. On this earth, Vrindavan, 90 miles southeast of Delhi, is a replica of the supreme Goloka Vrindavan located in the spiritual sky. When Krishna descended on this earth, he sported on that particular tract of land known as Vrindavan, comprising about 84 square miles in the district of Mathura. Namam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutalesha Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminitha Namini Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharanini Vishesha Sunyavadi Paskajaj. So in case the details didn't really, especially for those of you who are new here for the first time, they might not have been that, you know, meaningful. Well, what is, you know, so what about a Sarabi cow and or touch, you know, touchstones. Or, but the basic idea is this, that beyond this material world, there's a spiritual world, okay? And in that spiritual world, there are places just like this. There are people in that spiritual world. God is a person, and all the people in the spiritual world have a very beautiful, loving relationship with God, who's like the supreme person. You know, he's the person who's maintaining the whole show, so to speak, and he's somehow, believe it or not, it's inconceivable, he's interacting in a very loving way with all the inhabitants of the spiritual world. So much so that, you know, their experiences, they're experiencing boundless transcendental happiness realized through transcendental senses. They're basically madly in love with Krishna or God, you know, all the time. And they're feeling increasingly enlightened, not just, at, you know, for some time, but at every moment. That's the, you know, the general description of the spiritual world. And as mentioned here, this is just what you heard was a very brief description. But the idea is that that is where we want to be. You know, we don't want to be here in this material world. I have to give a little background information here to make this make sense. According to the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita in the Vedic literatures, each one of us is something more than just this material body. Obviously, we all have material bodies, but we're something more than just this material body. Everybody's heard that expression, right? He passed away or she passed away, right? Okay, so what passes away? You know, when somebody dies, the body's right there, but yet everybody, you know, that everybody's familiar with that expression, he passed away or she passed away. So the idea is that there's a soul inside the body, and the soul is eternal. And the soul doesn't die when the body dies. The soul isn't born when the body's born. The soul is something completely separate, and that's who we really are. And actually, according to the, you know, the Vedic scriptures, the Bhagavad Gita, the actual reality is that right now, we are souls inside a material body. We're fully thinking that this is, you know, we're this material body, and that's all we are. But the Bhagavad Gita tells us something different. The Bhagavad Gita tells us that actually, we're souls in this material body, and an illusion. We're thinking this is who we really are, and life, you know, life in this world is all that there is. But that's not the fact. That's not the case. The real fact of the matter is, or at least the information we get from the Bhagavad Gita is, that we are eternal souls. Originally, we were in the spiritual world with God, you know, with Krishna. And due to misuse of our minute free will, we've had to come here to this material world to be educated, to learn that we made a mistake and, you know, to learn how to correct that mistake so we can once again go back to the spiritual world. Just to use an analogy, which actually my spiritual master himself used, this is like, you know, it's like here in America. You start off as a free citizen. Everybody's a free citizen when you're born. Even if your parents are criminals, when you're born, you're a free citizen. But if you, you know, try to enjoy your life by living in defiance or in rebellion to the United States government, the laws of the land, then you're what's called a criminal. And most likely you'll get caught and you'll get put in a prison. And the prison is not a form of punishment, but it's punishment with a purpose behind it. The purpose of prisons ultimately is to reform, rehabilitate people so that they can become nice law-abiding citizens again and get out and contribute to the, you know, the society at large and enjoy their lives like that. So that's this material world. We're actually meant to be in the spiritual world. We were in the spiritual world. We were in the spiritual world with Krishna. And due to misusing our free will, we've come here to this material world. The idea is to get out of this material world and go back to be with Krishna eternally in the spiritual world. Okay? And I think at this point I'll read an excerpt of a conversation that took place here in Los Angeles, I think about 1973. This was it's a very brief excerpt. It was a conversation between our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, and a man named Dr. Stilson Judah, who was the chairman of the Theological Union at Berkeley, up in the Bay Area. Scholar and a professor and like that. So, and he was interested in Krishna consciousness, and more than just an academic way. He was actually, he was active. He was practicing to a certain extent himself. So anyway, so on this occasion, he said to Prabhupada, he asked a question. He said, do all souls fall out of the spiritual sky at once or at different times? Or are there any souls that are always good? They're not foolish. So this was Srila Prabhupada's reply. He said, majority, 90%, they're always good. They never fall down. See? So that's interesting. So in other words, 90%, well, actually, I better read on a little bit more because you're going to hear something even that qualifies that. Then Dr. Stilson Judah says, so we're among the 10%. And Srila Prabhupada says, yes, or less than that. In the whole material world, all living entities, they're just like in the prison house. There is some population, but they're not the majority. The majority of the population, they're outside the prison house. Similarly, majority of the living beings, part and parcel of God, they're in the spiritual world. Only a few fall down. See? So it's an interesting thing to, at least I find it an interesting thing to think about, that over, if you just spin the figures around, over 90% of the souls are in the spiritual world, are in the spiritual world with Krishna. And, they never fall down. So if you stop and think about it, that's just about everybody. I mean, like if I held up a glass of water right now that was over 90% filled, a glass, so you could see through it and everything, that was over 90% full with water, and I asked everybody, I said, what's in this, what do you see? You'd say, I see a full glass of water. Because if it's, 90% plus filled with water, you just, well, that's practically, So, there's practically all the souls are in the spiritual world. So it's not like it's such an impossible thing to be a soul in the spiritual world. This is a comment for those, sometimes devotees, we feel like it's, such a daunting thing to think that, to go back to the spiritual world. But, I mean, actually, a vast majority of souls are in the spiritual world. Right? It's not such a rare. Well, it is rare. It is rare to become a pure devotee once you're here in this material world and go back to Godhead. But it's not such an uncommon thing if you look at the bigger picture there. That, as I said, over 90% are there. This reminds me of an interesting story I heard, an anecdote. Just kind of throw some line. There was a friend of mine, he once said to a spiritual master, he said, boy, Chinese is like, it must be impossible. It must be so difficult to learn Chinese. And the spiritual master said, no, it's not. He said, no, really, Guru Maharaj, it must be very difficult to learn Chinese. I mean, it's such a hard language to learn. And the spiritual master said, no, I don't think so. And then he went back and forth. And then finally, the spiritual master said, no, I don't think so. He said, actually, all the 2 and 3 year old children in China know how to speak Chinese. Mm-hmm. So, it's a question of your perspective. It might seem difficult, but hey, it's true. So in the same way, maybe to us who are, here now in the material world, we're conditioned souls, we're struggling. There's one verse in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna says, Mamai Vamsa Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana Manaksastani Indidani Prakriti Stani Karshati, that these living entities, the souls, are my eternal fragmental parts and parcels. Like sort of Krishna's spiritual offspring, so to speak. And he admits, but right now they're struggling hard with the six senses. They're struggling hard in the material energy with the six senses, including the mind. So it seems very difficult to us, right? But there's a lot of hope. I mean, if you stop and think about this, as I said, it's a very natural thing to be in the spiritual world. There's a nice verse, I think it's from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. It goes, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prame Sabu Kabinaya Shravanade Sute Chitte Kore Udaya. That explains how pure love for Krishna is lying dormant within the heart of every living entity. And it just has to be awakened. You see? It's not like some people got it, some people don't. Sometimes you hear, oh, this person's a winner, somebody's a winner or a loser. It's not like that. Every soul has the potential to become a pure devotee and a lover of God. It's right there. As that verse said, it's lying dormant within our heart, and it has to be awakened by the process of chanting. Basically, what we were doing before the class began. That is the process for reawakening our dormant love for God. The chanting of the holy name of God, and also the chanting and the hearing of these scriptures, which were spoken by God Himself. When we chant, as we were doing earlier, just 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes ago, it actually purifies our consciousness. You see? Consciousness is not a symptom of the body. Consciousness is a symptom of the presence of the soul. You see? So when we chant, that purifies our consciousness. And as your consciousness becomes more and more purified by the chanting, then you start to... what happens is you start to understand more about who you are, who Krishna is, and what your eternal relationship is with Him. There's another nice verse from the another scripture called the Padma Purana. It goes, Atakshri Krishna Namari Nabhaved Grayam Indriye Seva Mukhehi Jivado Swayameva Spratyada. That Krishna can't be understood, God can't be understood by our blunt material senses. In other words, you'll never understand God by trying to figure Him out, so to speak. It doesn't work like that. Back a few weeks ago, one of the members of our community gave a class, and he gave this nice example in the class about this. There was this man who was trying very hard. He was down to understand about God. Who is God? What's my, like that. He was really struggling with that and really thinking hard. And he happened to be walking along the beach, and he saw this kid on the beach. And this kid was, had a coconut shell, half a coconut with the... And he was going to the ocean. He was taking a half a coconut shell of water and walking up and throwing it on the sand. And he was going back and forth. The man who was thinking about, trying to figure God and what's the nature, he walked up and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I've got this coconut shell and I'm trying to empty out the ocean." And the man said, "That's ridiculous." And then the boy looked at him and said, "Well, okay, well, what are you doing? What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm here and I'm trying to, understand about God." He said, "Well, you're doing the same thing as me. I'm using this coconut shell and try to empty out the ocean, which is, maybe futile. But you just have, with your little coconut brain there in your head, you're trying to understand about God is much inconceivably greater than even the ocean," like that. So in other words, you can't. We'll never be able to understand about God but using our intellectual prowess or anything like that. But in the Vedic literatures, the process is described as a method, and that is you submissively engage in this chanting the names of God, hearing and chanting about Him, and He becomes pleased by that. And what happens is when He's pleased by our efforts to engage in this process of what's called in Sanskrit Shravanam Kirtanam, hearing and chanting, then He reveals Himself. He actually reveals Himself to us. There's a very nice verse in the Bhagavad Gita. 10th chapter goes, Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam pritipurvakam vidami buddhi yogam tam yenam amupiyanti te Tesham eva anakam partam ahamagyana jamtamaha nasyami atmabhavashto jnana dipena bhashvata. And the translation for that is Krishna says, to those who are constantly devoted and worship Me with love. It's referring to this same thing, who are hearing and chanting constantly and doing it with the nice mood, a nice devotional mood. He says, Tesham, Vidami Buddha, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to Me. And then he goes on to say, out of compassion for them, I who am dwelling within their heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. See, that's how it works. You engage in this process of hearing, devotional service, which would be the broader classification of hearing and chanting is one item of the process of devotional service. But you do that, and then Krishna or God is pleased with with the sincerity of your efforts. When He is pleased with the sincerity of your effort to do that, then he reveals himself. You know, he destroys with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. See? And at that time, you can actually understand something about who you are, who Krishna is, and what your eternal spiritual relationship is with him. And when you get to that stage, then you'll realize that you've achieved life's perfection. This is the month of Damodar we're in now. It's a special time of year for devotees of Krishna. And probably right after this class, we're going to be singing a song. It's a prayer, you know, to Krishna and glorifying the pastimes of the activities of Krishna when he was a baby. Okay, so I was just kind of looking at that song earlier before I was giving the class. And I was, you know, a couple lines in the song really struck me. There's one line that says, this is the author of the song, his name is Srila Satyavrata Muni, says, those super excellent pastimes of Lord Krishna's babyhood drown the inhabitants of Gokula in pools of ecstasy. So in other words, when you actually, you know, surrender to this whole process, when you actually buy into it and you engage in this devotional service, this is the experience. You're drowned in pools of ecstasy. Another thing he says, I simply wish that, speaking to Lord Krishna, I simply wish that your childhood pastimes may ever be enacted in my heart. He goes, millions of opulences are of no use to me, but may this vision constantly remain in my mind. So in other words, when somebody is fortunate enough to come to the platform of pure devotional service, they realize that there's nothing greater to be gained. It's the perfectional experience. You know, there's nothing that can compare to it. There's nothing in the material world that even comes remotely close, and that's it. That's life's perfection. That's the philosophy that's of the Krishna consciousness movement. That's the philosophy that's being presented in the Bhagavad Gita, that our real happiness, you know, the real purpose of the human form of life is to revive our awareness of our eternal spiritual relationship with God, and that's our real happiness lies in that too. You know, it's not just something you got to do and like it or not. No, you will like it. It's the real happiness of the living entity is to be engaged in this reciprocal loving relationship with Krishna. So let's see. I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay, I've got a question. Can you speak louder? That's okay. Okay. Yeah, you're making some sense. There's not a lot of detail, at least in our scriptures, given about, you know, that specific point about, like, you know, the variety or intensity of offenses that one commits in order to come here to the material world. It's just the general principle is usually stated, which is that if you misuse your free will, if you try to, you know, live in defiance or in rebellion to the will of Krishna or God, then you can't be in the spiritual world. You have to come here to the spiritual world to learn that it doesn't work. You'll never be happy like that. And, you know, you have to live in compliance and submission like that and cooperation with the will of God. And then you can go back to the spiritual world. That's the basic, that's what's the basic message is there in the Vedic literature. There's not a lot of detail about, you know, but, I mean, there is similarity, to directly address your question, there is similarity in the sense that It sounds like in both traditions, there's an agreement there that before you can, you know, reach enlightenment or what we refer to as the spiritual world, you have to be, once again, you have to be in pure consciousness. You have to be a pure devotee. They don't, I mean, that idea is not there in Buddhism of a pure devotee of God, but you have to be in pure consciousness. You have to become free from being influenced by lust and anger and greed and all those kind of base material qualities. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Thanks for asking that question because, like, now that you mentioned it, that's a big, you know, that's a very, very important part of this worldview. I mentioned we're souls, and you know, we're in the spiritual world. Now we're here in the material world, but it is very important, to, especially for our first-time guests, to mention that it's not that you just get one chance at it, and if you get it right, wonderful. Congratulations, you're back in the spiritual world. And if you don't get it right for some reason, that you cease to exist or that's it, you've blown it and you're here forever. No. We believe in reincarnation. You take the soul, when it finishes with this material body, according to the quality of your activities during this lifetime, you'll be awarded another body, either material or spiritual. Okay? If your consciousness is completely pure at the time of, you know, death, at the time of quitting this body, then you won't get another material body. You'll be awarded a spiritual body. Or in other words, your original spiritual body will be reactivated. Okay, like when they reactivate an account, you know, something like that online. Yeah, so you otherwise, if you haven't quite made it to that level, then you'll get another material body. The body you get in your next lifetime will be determined, but once again, by the quality of your activities during this lifetime. You may get another human form of life. You may get another human body. You may not. There's no guarantee that you'll get a human body in your next lifetime. That's significant because the Vedic literature has explained to us that it's only in this human form of life that we can actually pursue this, God consciousness. It's only as a human being that you can actually engage in devotional service, purify your consciousness. See, so you really want to at least in your next lifetime get another human body so you can, if you don't, you know, fully complete the course, at least you can continue from where you left off in your next lifetime and make further progress. If after coming to the human form of life, if we slip back down again into lower species of life, it's tragic. It's a very unfortunate situation because it's a big waste of time. It's just suffering. And then what happens is you just mechanically, depending upon how far you go down, you mechanically go up, how would you say it? You mechanically go up again until you come back to the human form of life again. And then you're just back where you started from. Yeah, exactly. Not in any other form. Yeah, you can come back as anything. According to the Vedic literature, there's 8,400,000 species of life. And once again, depending upon the quality of your activities during this lifetime, you can take birth in any one of them. You know, if you're really, you know, as a human being, if you're totally materialistic and, you know, disregard all sorts of opportunities to improve yourself spiritually, then, yeah, you can be degraded into any one of those lower species of life. Got a question over there. Yeah. Yeah, great significance, great importance. In the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, God himself, says, Tad vidi paripatena paripashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tat padarshana. He says, just try to learn the truth. This is Krishna, God's recommendation, okay? He's saying, just try to learn the truth. Yeah. By approaching a bona fide spiritual master, inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. Upadekshanti tegyam. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. So it's of paramount importance. It's of paramount significance, to answer your question, to accept a bona fide spiritual master. If you're really serious about advancing and, you know, achieving life's perfection, actually it's you have to. You know, it's, you could there's things you could do up to a certain point, like you can read the Vedic literatures, you could be chanting, but at some point, if you really want to perfect the whole thing, you have to accept the bona fide spiritual master. You know, so it's a good question, and I hope I gave you a good answer there. Well, here in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, Srila Prabhupada was a bona fide spiritual master, and he has disciples who are following his instructions and have been for many, many, many years and have been authorized to act as initiating, as bona fide spiritual masters for, you know, people, newcomers, people who are coming along to this day and are interested in being connected to this unbroken chain of spiritual masters that goes right back to Krishna, actually. And it's called a parampara, you see? So, yeah, if you associate with the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, you will meet many bona fide spiritual masters, you know, as time goes on. Right here in this temple, for instance. Well, there's one verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, first chapter, I believe. It goes, Dharma projita kaita vochara parama nimasanano sitam. Anyway, it talks about how the Bhagavatam kicks out all materially motivated religions. In other words, one problem in religion is sometimes people, in the name of religion, they will... Let's think of an example. They'll water it down, you see? In other words, the religion is there, and at the same time they have their material desires, and they're trying to fulfill their material desires while still being, you know, considering themselves religion. And what happens is they'll use the authority of that religion, you know, to give absolute, you know, they'll use the religion to give absolute authority to their attempts to satisfy their material desires. So that's what's called Kaitava Dharma, cheating religion. And unfortunately, that happens. That happens, you know, quite a bit in the material world. And so what it is what you're really experiencing, and the reason why there's fighting, is because it's like a contaminated understanding of religion fighting against another contaminated understanding of religion. It's not pure. But the problem is that, you know, people aren't properly understanding the process for reawakening their dormant love for God. If they're focusing on things, you know, that are not, you know, in the name of religion, that are really just efforts to satisfy their own material desires. And that's, I think, where the conflict arises. That's not as good as the answers I'd like to give. That's the best I can come up with at the moment. I hope that kind of gives you a bit of an idea. Yeah. Anybody else? Any questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.